My name is Maria Town, and I'm the White House Disability Community Liaison. And welcome to the White House and American Association of People with Disabilities Disability and Inclusive Technology Summit. No. I know it's early, but you have all had coffee and been supplied with food. We can do better than that. You're at the White House at a summit on inclusive technology. There we go. Today's event is being live streamed at whitehouse.gov/live and on the White House YouTube channel. For those of you who are tweeters or folks who post on Instagram or Facebook, we are using two hashtags. One hashtag is design for all, and the other hashtag is inclusive tech. So please, on your posts, use one or both of those hashtags if the character count allows. I wanted to take a few moments to go over today's agenda just to give you a sense of the run of show. We will have remarks from our Chief Technology Officer, Megan Smith, and our Deputy Director for Technology and Innovation, Tom Khalil. Following that, we will have a keynote address from Daniel Castro. And following our opening remarks, we will all move down into South Court Auditorium, where the majority of our day will take place. And we will have five panels, the first on disability inclusion in the Internet of Things, the second on creating an environment to promote accessibility, which concerns how regulators, advocates, and technologists and industry can work together. Our third panel is on promoting innovation in assistive technology and prosthetics. Our fourth is on embedding accessibility in STEM education. And our fifth panel is focused on building relationships between industry and the disability community, and I hope a lot of that happens today. Just to note that for lunch, we will move back up into this room, so I hope you like your surroundings. And while he is not on our program, we do have a special guest who's surprised us. I wanted to take a moment to introduce Andrew Coy. He is the Senior Advisor for Making at the White House. Andrew?
Thank you, Maria. It is an honor to be here with you all this morning celebrating the inherent skills that you all bring to the table in the maker community. So, you know, by what you all face every day, you solve so many problems. And my job here at the White House is to support the maker movement, which allows for the production and the creation of solutions to be more democratized. So more people have access to the tools to make just about anything. And in my conversation with Maria over the past year or so, you know, what we've seen happening has been just humbling. And I am incredibly optimistic about the future of technology becoming more inclusive, but only as voices are articulated and the community sort of rallies around all the work that you all are doing day in and day out. So to kick off the morning, I know Chief Technology Officer Megan Smith is coming here to say a few remarks, as well as Tom Khalil. But let me just start the morning by saying that that as somebody you know, who works here every day at the White House and gets to see, you know, so many things happening around the country, what this conference, what this summit here today represent is amazing. So I'm excited to see how we can continue to amplify the great ideas that you all are bringing here today and tell the stories across the country of makers, of problem solvers, and individuals who care about building community wherever they are. So without further ado, okay, so I guess questions about how you can connect to the maker movement. One of the things that's happened over the past couple of years here at the White House is what's called the Nation of Makers Initiative. And the Nation of Makers Initiative is an effort to connect opportunities to more and more Americans. In the coming weeks and months, these efforts will live beyond the administration, and you know, there will be ways to connect to your local makerspaces or fab labs or tech shops. These are places that have tools to make just about anything, whether it's 3D printers or CNC or laser cutters or these types of technologies. But more importantly, they have communities there of individuals that you can connect with who can sort of help open up these possibilities, to teach how to use those tools if you don't already, or to connect you with others who have similar passions and interests that you have. So there's spaces, there's also events. If you're not familiar with things like maker fairs or these types of public events, they are fantastic ways to show off all of the creations that you have come to solve individual and larger global problems with technology. Additionally, there are organizations, and institutions that are interested in supporting this. One example that comes to mind right off is the work that the Health and Human Services with Idea Lab. So one thing that Susanna Fox, the Chief Technology Officer over there, has been focused on is how to increase in the healthcare industry the maker mindset. So how many times do nurses or patients have ideas for how things could be done better? And have simple solutions that sometimes just involve, tape and sort of fixing something, to more complex solutions that involve 3D designs for different ways products could be created. And so hospitals, there's 10 of them around the country that have already started down this path, have created makerspaces inside hospitals where nurses and patients can prototype and sort of present those ideas so that they can have a more they can have more input into how they are taken care of with the technology and tools. So Health and Human Services is very interested in this. There's interest across the board in the government. Just last week, we gathered together what's called an interagency working group, and this is part of the National Science and Technology Council. And Susanna Fox was there, along with representatives from the Department of Education, from the transportation, Department of Transportation, from DARPA, from across the military branches, from across the government, saying we want to listen and hear what the maker community is creating. So if you want to get involved, there are numerous ways in your local community. If you aren't familiar with the maker movement and you do want to reach out to Maria, I'm happy to put you in touch with somebody locally that you could get in touch with who would open up opportunities at a makerspace. If you're interested in applications that involve healthcare or other types of Internet of Things, I know you all are going to be listening to panels and having conversations this afternoon, but there's a whole entire community out there that is interested in working with you. Maybe one more example on this front. About 3 months ago, a group just south of DC here at Nova Labs, which is a makerspace, worked with an international organization called TOM Global, which is, they ran a hackathon. Now, hackathon is a condensed experience where people solve a problem and a team over a weekend. And so this usually involves programmers and designers and individuals that just are passionate about it. But this one was specifically focused on those with disabilities, and it brought them in, as they called them, the need knowers. And it spent a lot of time learning from them how whatever current setup was not working very well, whether it was opening a door or other types of small hacks and small changes that can make life easier. But instead of just designing for, it said, no, you are actually the most important sort of knowledge knower and designer in that equation. And if we don't have every team, deeply connected to and led by, then whatever the solutions are going to be what has currently been designed, which is, often not as conducive or as supportive. So, see yourselves as the need knowers, and the ability to design solutions will come from this community. And my job is to be better at listening and amplifying the solutions that you all come up with every day in and out. So as the senior advisor for making, my goal is to empower all of you to be makers of things and to solve problems that you come across every day in whatever capacity you're focused on. So whether it's education, healthcare, transportation, these are all areas that I know you have solutions or ideas for how they could be done better. And we're excited to listen to those, not only today, but well into the future. So with that, I will turn it over back over and say thank you all for coming here to the White House this morning, and looking forward to hearing throughout the day how the conversations progress.
Thank you so much, Andrew. We are working out some technical difficulties. Do you know what's up, Leo? Okay. But our next speaker, Megan Smith, is on the way, and I apologize for the delay. It's always great that at a tech summit, your tech fails. But that's the world we live in and work in. And now, everyone, I would like to welcome the Chief Technology Officer of the United States, Megan Smith.
Hello.
I have some images that I was just showing recently that might be useful to show, but we don't have to, so we'll see if we can plug them in or not.
You mean the HDMI like that? You go to that?
Yeah.
You don't? Okay, cool. We don't have to use them.
Okay. I can even hold them up.
All right.
So thank you so much for being here, and for those who've traveled from far especially. It's incredible work with Maria and the team, and one of the greatest things that the president wants to do is field the whole American team and get everybody involved. You know, ultimately, he comes from his community organizing background, and it's been our honor as the kind of the tech folks, kind of digital tech folks, he's created a seat for us in government. My job, the chief technology officer, is a new position with this administration. And it's really, how do you help the president and his team harness the power of data, innovation, and technology on behalf of the American people? And that can look like so many different things. Say how much data and innovation have been impacting our world, most recently with the digital networks that we've all invented together globally over the last couple decades and are really accelerating the use of. And so it feels like, in talking with Maria and the team, that these are really where the opportunity area is in terms of getting everybody in the room, everybody capable, everybody what we call creative confident. So think about the creative confidence that everyone could have if you could take the things you're passionate about solving and using any topic of the universe to solve them. And we could use all of the assets of our communities, not only all of the talent, but all of the resources. Think about the United States federal government. We're one of the richest things in the world, the richest thing in the world, if you think budget-wise. How do we take these assets and budgets and capabilities and that? How do we take the assets and capabilities of our local communities, of each other, and really use these new inventions that we have, this digital network technology, to really realize the potential and upgrade all these budgets, upgrade how we're working together? So we've been working as a team in three areas, and I thought I'd describe them because I could think they might capture imagination for how you all might think about this work. And already many people in the room and many people you're going to hear from today are already far ahead down this path on the thing I'm going to talk about. And so, you know, it's in their work that we want to come up and lift them up and accelerate. The first one is in the era of digital government. So we have, you know, we can make Amazon and Facebook and Google and Twitter and Dropbox and all these things. How about the federal government service delivery works that well? How about we do that? And the good news is, in addition to the teams that are already here, we've brought over 400 Americans who've built those technology companies to serve in this government. So we're creating just like, you know, how if people are a lawyer or an economist or a scientist, there's a seat in government at a senior level you would rotate in to the Supreme Court, you would rotate in as a lawyer, you would look at a resume of the legal world, and of course if they did clerking, it's a really respectable, incredible thing to have done, and many lawyers, if you look at those resumes, have done that. But with our techie digital kind of Burning Man people, the sort of TEDxers and who are off doing their thing. The president went to South by Southwest and said, I need your help. I need civic engagement. I need a tour of duty. You don't have to come forever. You can keep doing whatever you're doing, but I need you to come for part of your career. Because I got a lot of great, you know, restaurant delivery apps. I got some other problems I need help with. You know, and if we can make a car drive itself, couldn't we work on rural child poverty together in some new way? How is it that we feed 22 million children during the school year because we figure out access through school or after-school programs, places where they are, but we want to make sure we know that they're actually eating in the summer, so we have some constraints that are valid about seeing them, because maybe an older sibling takes the food or it gets left behind or whatever, so we have to see them eat. But it means that we only feed 6 million kids in the summer. They are hungry. But we could make a car drive itself, right? Like I said. So why can't we fix that? And so the way we fix that is by becoming extremely cross-functional, the way we've solved the hardest problems together in the past. I mean, President Washington started the Army Corps of Engineers before the country was founded. You know, President Kennedy took us on the Apollo mission. When we faced great challenges of crisis response or war, you know, World War II, we together invented computers. Computation, we needed computation. If you saw that movie, Imitation Game, about Bletchley Park, I was just in the UK last week, they used coding to catch the encrypted signals coming on the radio, listening. 40 motorbikes a day coming into Bletchley Park, teams of mathematical people, saving 11 million lives and shortening the war by 2 years using decryption mathematics and inventing what became computing. And that happened in the United States too, with the ENIAC team at the University of Pennsylvania. We just pushed ourselves because it was required, and so we did it. And the one thing that's not well known about both of those stories is that Bletchley Park was two-thirds women, technical women. And ENIAC was Eckert and Mockley, the famous hardware designers, but six women, the first digital programmers in America. So we need to lift all the stories and also the practices that we could do. And so it's in that spirit that in this time, President Obama is championing us. And so it's maybe my call to all of you is, how do we get really cross-functional in solving these incredible challenges and opportunities that we have? To use these new methods, it could be crowdsourcing and the sharing economy. The way we together write things like Wikipedia. Who knew that you could have so much passion become visible? We humanity are passionate about the topics we know, and we want to make sure they're written correctly on the internet. And therefore, we've written an encyclopedia together that actually fills this building if you were to try to print it out. That's powerful. We are powerful. You know, when we get ourselves in our right seats. And so what is it that your neighbor knows in this room that if you guys collaborated together, we could just take it, you know, to whole other levels together? And how do we add these techie folks? Because it's in the .com sector that we're accelerating, but we haven't been doing that as much on the .gov sector and the .org sector. Maybe on the .edu sector, the students are all doing this, and some of the faculty. But how do we bring sort of this new methodology in? So we've been doing that across service delivery, across upgrading digital modern government, around collaboration. One of the projects the president has is in the area of kind of capacity building the nation. There's been a lot of work locally on promise zones and community solution ideas. And so now we have a community of practice that is over 800 federal employees have now joined, and every 2 weeks they do innovation exchange calls. And they're typically in their silos of housing or healthcare or education or other sectors, but now they're talking to each other in ways that we can, because we have this internet. It's not magical, it's just a magic way to be connected to each other, because together we're magical. And so now we're doing that in regions, and most importantly, thinking about the federal government as a platform or a stage on which the community will do what it wants to do together, and that we could lift the innovators of those communities. So I'll give you an example of what I'm talking about. In the area of criminal justice, we have extraordinary challenges as a country. We have a very large number of people who are in jail who face substance abuse or mental health crisis. and we hadn't figured out how to handle or help that person in the right way, and the recidivism, other challenges are daunting. So the challenges additionally in the country around bias and racism are there too with policing, and we also need to deeply protect our incredible police forces. So how do we dive into the data and the best practices and start sharing and accelerating work there? So the president called for the 21st Century Policing Task Force. That group met and held public meetings, three different spaces, heard incredible ideas and challenges from us reflecting back, and came up with a set of recommendations. As a tech person, 14 of them were digital tech. And so we sort of started to champion and listen for what we call scout and scale, listen for and look for people who already had done extraordinary things. And actually in this room, we welcome 30 police leaders, chiefs, and four of them to kick off the day with lightning talks, because it turns out they were way ahead of everybody. Two of them were ahead in terms of open data and transparency. The chief of police of Dallas and leadership from Los Angeles were already opening data sets around use of force data, officer-involved shooting, all of this best practice you could do, like, you know, the open data that lets us see the weather on our phone, or the open data from the Department of Interior and U.S. Geological Survey that lets those companies make those mapping applications that help us get here, help us see where to go, help us do driving directions, et cetera. So are there data sets for justice and equality that can be released? And the president has released over 200,000 data sets from all different departments, and we're seeing all kinds of innovation happening on top of this. And this is a particular one that these leaders were releasing locally from their local jurisdictions. And they were able to share what they were doing. This is early work, how it was being received, and how people were starting to use the data to see things that they might not have seen together and create transparency and trust. And so they were able to communicate that, and then a workshop with the other police leaders allowed them to begin to consider that option for their community. That became something called the Police Data Initiative, and now we have over 100 jurisdictions who are now practicing that, and in a community practice of peer-to-peer innovation and learning, of sharing what they're doing, engaging community, and every single jurisdiction there commits to open three data sets and engage with the community in an event. The New Orleans team was just I have a fabulous picture of a 10th grader teaching the police chief, the chief of police, how to code. And she's an amazing, talented young woman who is now teaching the 7th graders, doing all those things that she's really getting her creative confidence. He's getting creative confidence. Everybody's diving in to work together on this super hard problem. The other two speakers at that event were began something called Data Driven Justice. And that was an idea that had more to do with less transparent open data like the weather and the mapping ideas. But it was more about enterprise data or the city data that the people who are serving people have privately. So it might be health data, it might be the emergency room, it might be something from criminal justice or the local jail. It could be homelessness information, family information, health and services information, foster information. What they noticed, this was two leaders. One was from Camden, New Jersey, and the other from Charlotte Mecklenburg. And so those two groups, and then a group we discovered in Miami, were doing really innovative things, and they were able to, same thing. Instead of leaving TEDx and Burning Man and all that just to the techies, we're able to do short lightning talks that teach each other information about breakthrough things that each of us have done, and I know you're going to be doing some of that today. So what this Camden leader did was he told us about several innovations around community policing and getting people out of their desks and out into the community. He said the presence of justice would be that the presence of justice with the community out in the neighborhoods. It wouldn't just be pure security but locked down, but we'd be out in a vibrant area, vibrant community. He had a very high murder rate and other challenges. And they had overcome extraordinary odds and really dropped the statistics in ways that were very impressive. So how he did that, we got the teams involved, but also around data. They identified that 205 people were kind of super users of the system, were trapped in a system of hitting homelessness and healthcare and criminal justice and that. And they could think differently about that group of people if they could notice between their silos and integrate that work a little bit. And they did that, and so they dropped their budget to 20% the cost, and they helped people. in a much stronger level. Another example would be Miami-Dade. Miami-Dade also concerned about mental health and substance abuse disorder challenges for their community, especially the over-arresting of this group. And so they created a small 12-bed stabilization unit in their emergency room, in their hospital. And so now if you're a police officer, they train the police officers, they train 911, you had an option. If you face someone with this challenge, they could still take them to jail, you could still take them to the ER, but you had this third place. And so they train folks on how to de-escalate and bring people here. So across 4 years, they had 50,000 people present in this form that they took to this place and only 109 arrests. And they went from 70,000 people in jail to 4,900 and closed a prison. So that's an idea we're stealing, right? And sharing and understanding. And so creating communities of practice and working groups, because what I've found in this job is that Americans have solved problems. They've solved many of their problems. They have either completely solved them or they're on a path that's incredibly valuable to follow. And so if we could hear from each other what we already got and use that same thing that they're using that we're using for writing Wikipedia, what is someone passionate about that they already know about, that they're already working on together? What have you learned and what's the result? And how do I do that too? And how do I do that too faster? Could you make a video, write it down, write a playbook, put it on the internet, let's do a call, and let's go. Just the same way that the open source people are doing stuff. Today, when our incredible coders on the planet are working, most of them work in a sharing, they're the most sharing people. They use open source, and what they do is they post their code for free, typically. And then when they want to write something similar to that, they've used the system fine and they take part of it. And if you talk to most programmers, they'll tell you if they're writing 10 lines of code, often 6 of them are written by someone else. They're just adding to that and expanding on the body of human knowledge. And then they repost it. We just launched the federal open source code.gov sites. We're going to do that with the federal government. And it's really going to help us mostly because most traffic's local. Most of the things we need to reuse are we need to use between agencies, and a whole bunch of other people benefit from it too. And the security and quality of the code will go up because it's in the sunlight and we can see it. Really exciting stuff. So I guess it's sort of how do we take these practices in the president's spirit of going to South by Southwest to use this way of collaborating, working together, way that the data-driven justice and police data initiative teammates are doing. What is it that you all know either someone in this room is already doing or someone you know is already doing that would benefit everyone in this country and on the planet? And how do we use each other to more rapidly accelerate those things and make them happen? And then how do we also remember a really important part, which is back to the story of sort of Bletchley Park or the ENIAC and that World War II idea is... how do we make sure everybody plays and we tell the whole story? We have a weird idea in our country about stereotypes that there's technical people and there's not technical people. And when I say that, you can probably feel that in your gut because you're right back in third grade. Right? And in third grade, math and science was kind of boring or kind of intimidating for most people. Some people thought it was awesome because they had been off doing projects or whatever it was, so they were really listening because they already knew it was cool. And so they paid attention all the way through. The rest of the people were like, what's this for? Why are you making me feel like an idiot when I take this test? Why do we make people feel bad and unincluded when they're learning? We got to learn all the subjects in the planet. And so we sort of did this weird stereotype thing where we decided that some people would be, you know, you can't graduate from high school and say, have you ever met anyone who said, yeah, reading, it wasn't my thing? But you've definitely met people who say, yeah, there's some people who get that, but most people say, and I'm slightly dyslexic, so I might tell you that, there's some people who would always say, yeah, math and science, that wasn't for me. We cannot do that because being critical thinkers and writers and readers and argument makers and storytellers is just, it's important and equal to being computational thinkers and understanding scientific method and discovering things and knowing that the first time you do it, it never works usually, and having the confidence that the reason why it didn't work wasn't because you're not supposed to do it, you're the wrong race or gender or the wrong person, but just because that's how science and tech works. And that just like writing a great essay, the first draft is going to be too long and messy and sometimes unintelligible. Just like the first time you hit it, you know, the first Edison filament did not work, right? Or Grace Hopper. Grace invented coding languages, an Edison-level American. People told her, why would anyone ever want to write this way? She's like, well, if we keep in the machine code, we can't get more people involved. So she made a translator called a compiler, and she wrote in an English-like language that became COBOL, which is now Java and Perl and all these things, so that more of us could participate, right? But people didn't believe her that was a good idea, but we needed her to do that. So I guess that's my main thing in all my collaboration with Maria. She knows more than I'll ever know about the topics that she knows. And I know some about these things, and if we can work together, we can do extraordinary things, and I think that's true of everybody in this room. And it's really what, back to the president as our kind of community organizer, techie president. He was just in Pittsburgh, where we hosted the Frontiers Conference, and really pushing on us, and he's edited this issue of Wired Magazine. How do we think through, the frontiers that we have, which are really getting everyone involved in the passionate things that they would love to work on, and using all the tools of the universe. He focused on five frontiers in that event. One was personal frontiers, which you guys are going to do a lot of work on today. What is it that we can do to extend ourselves, to help ourselves around personalized medicine, around augmentation and helping each other with any kind of ability that we want to address, hearing and seeing and all of the senses? What might we do with cancer moonshot and really working together to solve what the vice president is leading us on? What might we do with the brain initiative and understanding how our mind works and helping each other with everything from Alzheimer's to artificial intelligence? What might we do about personalized learning so that there's not that third grade moment that everybody really feels like we just adapt to what they need in order to learn anything? One of my favorite people in this is Suzuki, the Suzuki violin method. He was, I got to meet him when he was 92, he's amazing and still teaching. And he, his theory was that people learn their native language to such an intricate level that it was a proof point that anyone could master anything. Because the parents and the community aren't requiring you to learn in a particular way, they adapt to that infant, to that toddler, however that child is responding back, and it's a dynamic system that's so cool, right? For how we learn language and how we kind of understand our world and how we come into being as tiny children. And it was in that he felt that you could adapt systems so people could learn anything. And he decided to teach math one year to fourth graders. And he said, every child in my class will get 100% on every test. And he just adapted himself to the kids and he did it. And so that's that personal frontier that we have, that what if everybody had what they needed and also understood about peace and collaboration. There's a group in Muscogee Creek, Illinois, or Muscogee Creek, Oklahoma, tribe that's teaching robotics and Head Start, and they're doing it in collaborative ways, 3-year-olds, 4-year-olds. So that confidence that could happen from him learning that. The second frontier was about communities and local smart cities and that local space, which to the president is not only that underpinning layer of infrastructure and cars and transport and that side, but it's also the smart communities, which include the example I was giving around data-driven justice, using data science to solve the community's problems together and include everyone. The third area was a national one. We've been having a conversation about artificial intelligence and machine learning. And that was a conversation about not only the policy there, which we've had open town halls all summer with our different academic leadership across the country, and there's a new report out on the future of AI, and the Wired magazine talks about it. How do we know about law and policy, safety and control, impact on the economy? We're going to transition like the agriculture age and industrial age now into this age of digital. We're part of that. How's it going to affect our jobs, and how do we transition there and include everybody? But also, how do we make sure that we're using these tools for good, for government service delivery, for inclusion? And so that was that national conversation. And then a global conversation about climate change, about green energy, We've gone from 3% green energy to 7 generation and arcing. Really exciting new area for jobs and innovation. I was just in Buffalo, New York, my hometown. I was in a solar city factory. They're going to pull 75 trucks a day full of solar panels to install across the United States. That's amazing, right? To think about that's a new future for all of us, green energy. And then the last one was interplanetary. So the Roddenberry family, of course, needed to open that day, if you think about our Star Trek future, right? And what's cool in the Star Trek future is not only is all this tech there, you know, we could communicate and beam, and there's that universal translator and Uhura and her strategy of getting people going along, and Scotty, you know, with the dilithium crystals and all this stuff that's, you know, there, tricorders and healing. But really it's the second part of what's in Star Trek, which is this dual truth. The other part, which is the deck has all of us. We're all on the deck. And we're doing interesting things, exploring and discovering and communicating and being peaceful and being participants in the world. So I don't know, I want to end there. My colleague Kumkali, I'll have a piece up next, but we work very closely together in the Office of Science, Technology, Policy and how we can bring any of these capabilities of science and tech into any of the sectors. And it feels like that's really the opportunity here, is to get these voices heard better using social media and getting the support we need from colleagues, and then getting the innovation moving in the most collaborative, let's call it Wikipediaized, collaborative way to really drive for these solutions. I got to work in the media lab with Hugh Hare, who has his own bionic legs that he's designed, and they're so beautiful and cool. And so how he's empowered himself and the community with the designs and technologies that he's added in with others. So I'll end there and just thank you. I'm looking forward to what will come today from the nexus of the conversations of all of you being here and the networks that you're connected to out across the country and across the world, and how we could accelerate everyone included at the table in anything they want to do, not just included as a member, but also as a fundamental designer and creatively confident person who's adding what they want to add to the conversation and to the world in ways that they deserve and we all need so desperately. So thank you so much. We have a document that my team created with Tom and others that we gave to the U.S. Conference of Mayors about really interesting local innovations. So we'll pass those out. It's just a laundry list of everything from this kind of open engagement I was talking about with Justice or Opportunity Project, those kinds of using open data for solving local problems, to STEM and tech inclusion, to connectivity and other things. So just maybe a useful resource set, and we can email it out too. So we'll give that out to you guys.
Were you in here?
No, we're all good. Thank you. Yeah. Does that work? Do you need me to move it? Yep. Awesome. Oops, sorry.
That's good. Cool. All right. Thank you so much, Megan. I'm not sure if she's still in the room, but thank you, Megan, for those remarks. I'd now like to introduce Deputy Director of the Office of Science and Technology Policy, Tom Kalil. And that's K-A-L-I-L.
Thank you. It's a pleasure for me to be here this morning. Is everyone fired up and ready to go? All right. This issue of universal design and making sure that we're designing particularly information and communications technology, so that they can be used by everyone, is something that I've been interested in for a while. And I had the opportunity to work for President Clinton in the 1990s, which we sometimes call those dark days of peace and prosperity. One of the things I had the opportunity to work on was building a collaboration between the National Science Foundation, leading IT companies like IBM and Microsoft, and the disabilities community, and the World Wide Web Consortium. And so out of that came the Web Accessibility Initiative, which was really an effort to design, make sure that the standards for the web, HTML tools, content authoring tools, and the web browsers themselves were designed from the very beginning with accessibility in mind. And I just, at the risk of preaching to the converted, I think that worrying about these issues at the beginning of the development of a technology makes a lot of sense, as opposed to trying to, you know, retrofit and bolt on solutions after they've been widely deployed. And I think it's the if you believe that every human life is of equal value, it's the moral thing to do. So it's the right thing to do. It's the just thing to do. As the U.S. population and population around the world. As we have more and more people who are senior citizens, I think it's going to be the profitable thing to do, because more people are going to have to deal with one form of disability or another. And I think that worrying about universal design winds up improving functionality for everyone. So in the same way that curb cuts are not only useful for people on wheelchairs, they're also useful for married couples with strollers that are, pushing their kids around. So from all those points of view, I think that the work that you're doing is really important. And I just wanted to throw out a couple of examples of, so one thing I wanted to do is to tell you about a thought experiment that I posed to the members of my team that I would be interested in your answer to during the course of today's work. A thought experiment that I posed to the members of my team is to imagine that you have a magic laptop. And the power of the laptop is that any press release that you write will come true. And what you have to do is to come up with a headline that is a goal statement, several paragraphs that provide context, and paragraph-level descriptions of who is agreeing to do what in the form, organization A takes action B to achieve goal C. And the constraint that you have to operate under is that it has to be at least plausible that the individual members of this coalition of the willing that you're building, that might include federal departments and agencies, philanthropists and foundations, companies, research universities, and civil society organizations, would be both willing and able to take the actions that you've identified. So you can't ask an agency to do something that is against the law unless your press release also includes Congress passes a law. And you couldn't ask a company to take some action that is directly contrary to the interest of their shareholders. But subject to those constraints, you can imagine pulling together some coalition with a shared vision, a goal that they want to achieve, and identifying the mutually reinforcing actions that would allow the United States or the world as a whole to achieve that goal. So that's one thought experiment, and I wanted to challenge the group to answer that question. What would you do if you had that magic laptop? The other thing I wanted to say is that it's always worthwhile to think about, given that this is a community, that this is a challenge that we've been working on for a while, are there Are there new tools that we have that might accelerate the rate at which we achieve these goals of universal design and more inclusive products and services for information and communications technologies? So the Department of Education, for example, has been supporting a center that is now based at the University of Maryland and a consortium called Raising the Floor, which is asking the question, what are the new opportunities for universal design and more accessible technology that are created by cloud-based services that can translate content and services from one format to another? So that would be one example. A second example is that there is a growing use both within the government and the private sector in tools of open innovation. And these are inspired by an observation from Bill Joy, who was one of the co-founders of Sun Microsystems, who said, no matter who you are, most of the smartest people work for someone else. So as opposed to assuming that the people within your own organization are going to be able to solve something, how can you describe the problem in a way that lots of people can contribute to it? So if there are some challenges, how do we describe those so that lots of people can work on them? So, for example, I've been able to work with Congress to pass legislation that gives every agency the ability to support incentive prizes for up to $50 million. And if you go to the website challenge.gov, you'll see over 700 instances in which agencies have identified problems that they're working on, and in some cases, are providing a cash award to whichever team can achieve those goals. A third example of something that has changed recently is, and Megan alluded to this in her remarks, is the really phenomenal advances that are occurring in the field of machine learning. So within the space of a handful of years, the ability of algorithms to look at pictures and then to automatically caption those pictures, the error rate declined from 25% to 30% to now 3%. So meeting or exceeding human levels of performance in the ability to automatically label images. So that required something called a training data set. So dramatically improved the ability of the development of these algorithms to take an input and provide the desired output. So given that rate of technological change in this area, it would be interesting to find out is whether there are people who are exploring the opportunities at the intersection of machine learning and issues related to universal design and assistive technology. So that's what I wanted to leave you with today. Think about what you would do with a magic laptop. How would you use that for good rather than for evil? And then what are some things that are changing about the world, the increased power of the cloud, the idea of embedding issues around universal design and accessibility at the beginning of the development of a technology, the increased use of open innovation as a tool for stimulating innovation, things like incentive prizes and challenges, and taking advantage of this phenomenal advances that we're seeing recently in areas like machine learning. And so I'm really looking forward to finding out what ideas that you have that this administration or the incoming administration can help advance. And thanks for coming to the White House and spending some time with us today. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom. I know he asked what more the administration could do, and I will caveat that and say, what can we do within 73 days? which I think is what time we have left, but we still have a lot more to do. So I'll speak for Tom and say that he was serious about that ask. So now that we've included the concluded the administration portion of the event, we are going to move to South Court Auditorium, which there's a little bit more space, so breathe a sigh of relief. And then we will kick off our keynote when we get down there. Thank you so much.